You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land we're retreat broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. It is the 5th of March. Good morning, Inez.
Good morning.
Oh, yes, that's right. I can say good morning and hear you, but unfortunately, our lovely listeners cannot.
Good morning.
Well, it emphasizes how much I miss the station when I'm not here. But when I'm here, you turn my mic on, I'm ready.
You're ready to go. I'm not ready to go. That shows how ready I am.
Yeah.
Gosh, how have you been?
It's a very heavy time. Everything feels, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know that feeling? Like not in a despondent way or like I feel rageful. I feel ready to act and do more. But yeah. How do you feel?
It feels like there's a lot of uncertainty. A lot of things are in flux and I can understand if people are feeling overwhelmed and like struggling to comprehend all of the information that's coming at them at the moment. I mean, that's why we try and do the interviews that we do to help break things down and, you know, give people a better understanding of what's happening in the world so we know how to act.
Yeah.
So to start off with, do you want to kick us off with what we've got on the show today, Inez?
Yes, we we'll listen to a recent conversation between Alice and Spanish and Latin American Studies PhD researcher Sasha Gillis-Lukakis about the energy crisis facing Cuba due to the recently increased fuel blockade by the United States. Yeah, you can catch Sasha on 3CR's Latin American Update and Unitarian half-hour shows and follow the work of the Australia-Cuba Friendship Society.
Yeah, nice. And after that, we are lucky to be joined again by Peter Kernow, award-winning investigative journalist, writer, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia, who spoke with me yesterday to discuss the Five Eyes intelligence agreement between Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, as well as the United States, and the role of Australia's Pine Gap Signals Intelligence Facility in light of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. This is a really important thing to revisit because I think, you know, without boots on the ground, it's easy for a lot of people to say, oh, you know, how is Australia involved? But as Peter takes us through, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Absolutely. It seems like our theme for this show is very much about accountability processes, which
yes.
I really like. And next we have Edio Diaz from Centre Against Racial Profiling, who joins me to discuss the safety and accountability concerns with the extension of Operation Pulse until the end of this year. Now, you might have noticed Victorian police patrols increasing in shopping centres as well as protective service officers or PSOs. However, these aren't shopping centres, particularly areas that are racially discriminated against. Now, this is $6.5 million reinvestment and they are searching people without warrants. So it really raises accountability concerns and concerns around human rights abuses. And that is a area that Ilio directly works with.
Yeah. I mean, as a member of the Center Against Racial Profiling, I can only give my resounding endorsement for Ilo's fantastic work. After that, we're going to be listening to an interview with Georgia Shields and Nina Story from the formerly incarcerated Justice Advocates Melbourne Collective, or FIGJAM. And they'll be speaking about the dehumanizing practice of strip searching in the Australian correction system and why this practice needs to end. Now, this interview is going to include some distressing themes and will provide some support services that you can call if you want to speak to anyone about that. But also Nina does provide a bit of advice at the start of the interview as well for how to, you know, sit with the feelings that come up during the interview and lean into the support networks that you have. Now, FigJam, FlatOut, and Human Rights Law Center have just launched a co-authored report titled Ending Strip Searches in Australian Prisons, and this details the harm, prevalence, and ineffectiveness of strip searching, drawing on a combination of information that was obtained by FOI requests and the testimony of formerly incarcerated people. And we'll have information in our show notes about where you can read that report and also donate to support FigJam's collective work, as well as sign a petition calling on the federal government to ban strip searches.
And lastly, we have Sarah Bloomfield, who will be joining us to share more about the Don't Fly Thai, a campaign rejecting the transport of F-35 fighter jets from so-called Australia to Israel on commercial passenger planes. And this morning, Sarah will give us the latest on the campaign, actions including protests at Melbourne and at Sydney International Airports on the 25th of February, which promoted a global response via social media coverage. And we recommend revisiting our two-part interview with Peter Cronow from Declassified Australia, which Priya's also mentioned, and yeah, listen back to our previous episodes.
Yes, excellent interview, Inez. It was really important, I think, lays the groundwork for understanding the transport of these items and components via commercial flights. You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Tune in for a special broadcast on March the 5th, 2 PM, for Dissociative Identity Disorder Awareness Day 2026. This year, we will be continuing our conversations on dissociation and complex trauma with the theme of navigating medical systems. Dissociative disorders and complex trauma are highly stigmatized in society, and seeking professional help is no exception. Join me, Amy Ciara, and other people living with dissociative disorders and complex trauma, and our stories of what it's like navigating medical systems. That's right here on 3CR Community Radio. March the 5th, 2 PM.
Welcome back. These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 5th of March. Opposition continues to grow to the Albanese Labor government's support for the United States, Israeli illegal and unprovoked attacks on Iran and Lebanon, with protests expected to continue across the country in the coming days. Now, activist groups and unions are calling on the Australian government to cut military ties with Israel and the United States and to transparently review the use of intelligence facilities such as Pine Gap, which are suspected to have been used during attacks on the Iranian people. To date, the US and Israeli attacks have killed more than 1,000 people in Iran and at least 50 people in Lebanon, with strikes and retaliatory attacks spreading across several Middle Eastern countries. In Lebanon, Israel is bombing residential areas, ending a ceasefire it has already violated more than 15,000 times. The head of the United Nations nuclear watchdog said yesterday, inspectors have not found evidence of a coordinated Iranian program to build nuclear weapons, contradicting the false allegations that attempt to justify the attacks from the US and Israel.
Also in news this week, a constitutional challenge to the Chris Minns government anti-protest laws begins today in the New South Wales Supreme Court. The case is led by Elizabeth Jarrett, a Gumbunya, Dungudi and Bundjalung woman, along with Dungudi activist Paul Silver and Josh Lees from the Palestine Action Group, who were all assaulted by police during a protest against the Israeli President Isaac Herzog in early February. The activists' case seeks to overturn current restrictions that suppress the right to protest and were specifically installed to attempt to suppress Palestinian solidarity protests.
In other news, following almost a decade of repeated mishandling of a case involving police misconduct, the independent board-based anti-corruption commission, known as IBAC, has apologised to NAM woman Jana Katteringskaja for failing to correctly manage a family violence case. Now, IBAC has referred the case involving her former partner, a serving police officer, back to Victoria Police for investigation. In a community, Melbourne Legal said the case exposes critical flaws in IBAC's ability to investigate police conduct that must result in an overhaul of the current system. Now, IBAC fails to investigate more than 98% of police misconduct complaints, in part because it is required to prioritise resources to investigate corruption over police misconduct complaints, even when referring a complainant back to Victoria Police could result in significant risk or harm to the complainant. Now, legal experts have called for major reforms to strengthen independent oversight of police, including new legislation and a dedicated division to investigate police corruption and misconduct.
Finally, in news headlines, advocates are calling on state governments to ban strip searching in prisons, with recent research findings describing the practice as degrading, harmful, and ineffective. The report by the Human Rights Law Centre, Flat Out, and formerly incarcerated Girls Justice Advocates Melbourne, or FIGJAM, draws on lived experience accounts and national data, finding thousands of strip searches occur each month despite little evidence they uncover contraband. The practice disproportionately harms First Nations people and women, trans and gender diverse prisoners, and though less invasive options such as body scanners exist, prisons are continuing to opt to breach the rights of incarcerated people by subjecting them to strip searches.
Now, something else that we wanted to promote during these news headlines is a couple of upcoming events that are being organised by Rising Red Lantern at Vixen, and it's a collaboration with the community Collective Justice for Our Sisters. The event, the first event, is going to be Asian migrant sex workers and sex worker survivors of violence speak out, and it takes place at the front of the State Library of Victoria on Saturday, the 14th of March, with the speaking program beginning at 4:30 p.m. But people are also invited from 3 p.m. to make red lanterns and to hang them at the event. And these lanterns will later be brought to court because there are two upcoming court dates on Monday, the 16th of March. There's a Supreme Court appeal hearing for the killings of Yuki Low and Hyun Suk Jeon. And on Wednesday, the 18th of March, the Melbourne Magistrates Court will be holding a committal mention for the killing of Yuko at Rainbow Garden in Footscray. So to find out more and support the work of Rising Red Lantern, you can look up Rising Red Lantern on Instagram and also follow Vixen Workers on Instagram as well. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 5th of March, and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It's 7:14. Now, first up, we listen to a recent conversation between Alice and Spanish and Latin American Studies PhD researcher Sasha Gillis-Lukakis about the energy crisis facing Cuba due to the recently increased fuel blockade by the United States. Now, you can catch Sasha's program on 3CR Latin American Update and Unitarian Half Hour shows. But for now, let's take a listen.
Some people are saying, and I mean, you know, this was even admitted as such by some people in the US government, particularly Florida-based senators, that part of the reasoning behind the kidnapping of the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, was because Venezuela was sending such vast amounts of petroleum to the islands in order to keep all of those services running. And now, with the removal of the kidnapping of Maduro, and, you know, it's very complicated sort of dance we've got going between the US and Venezuela. I'm not exactly sure what's going on right now, but no fuel is leaving Venezuela for Cuba. It hasn't since the start of this year. There was news this morning that potentially the US is now going to permit Venezuela to export fuel to Cuba, but only if it's sent to private companies,
yeah,
which is still better than nothing because, you know, that will still eventually make its way into, you know, certain critical services. But, you know, it is still being very selective and trying to block the state and the state sector from being able to function properly.
And that's still exploiting an already exploited country and people. So that, you know, it's better than nothing, but it's still going to be nothing for a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly right, exactly right. And, you know, we don't even know so much of what this current US administration says is bluff or lies. We have to wait and see, you know, to see exactly how much, if any, is actually going to be sent now to Cuba. And, you know, there are other countries that are preparing fuel supplies to send to the islands. As I mentioned, Mexico is discussing with the US ways to get some sort of exemption from this new oil blockade to be able to send some fuel across. Of course, Mexico has its own very complex relationship with the United States that it has to navigate. It's very dependent on the US economy. So, you know, it does have to take those threats seriously. But also some larger countries, of course, in Eurasia, China, Russia, Iran, have announced that they're preparing fuel packages, but they are actually seriously considering at the moment, do they need to send submarines or Navy vessels to actually protect those flotillas? So that's what's being basically teased out at the moment, because we don't know what the US is going to do if those vessels attempt to get into Cuba.
When we think about these sanctions, for a large part of American diplomacy, it's meant to be to, you know, in some way be against the government, but this is obviously just affecting the everyday people. So I wonder, like, how does these sanctions even get just, like, what are they trying to spin this as?
Yeah, so the beginning of this oil blockade about 3 or 4 weeks ago was preceded by a US statement of a declaration of national emergency over Cuba. And this was published on the White House website. It was a document that basically stated Cuba represents a unique and extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States, which, of course, anyone who has a brain and a pair of eyes can see that that is the farthest thing possible from
it's
the truth.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous. But, of course, the United States doesn't care. You know, they are still, even if they're declining, they are still a hegemon, particularly in Latin America. So, you know, these sorts of justifications, even though they sound ridiculous to everyone, you know, the US does still have that, at least some degree of a monopoly on force and those economic measures to do as it pleases. And in the original legislation that was passed in the early 60s for the sanctions, you can actually go online and you can read the opening preamble, and it is very clear that the purpose of the sanctions is to make life so miserable and unbearable for Cuba's people that they rise up and they overthrow the socialist government. So that is actually written into the preamble of the legislation. So, you know, when they say that they're only targeting the government with these sanctions, you know, they themselves have admitted in their own documents that that is not the case. That the purpose, as you said, is to make life as hard as possible for everyday people, to the point that they basically weigh up, well, is it just easier if we give up this project and we return to the US fold?
Yeah.
But of course, you know, there's one thing doing that and saying that in the legislation and, you know, listening to what the exile community in Miami are saying, because that's one of the main reasons this legislation is still in force, because they have such an iron grip on politics in Florida, which is in turn so important for national elections in the United States. But, you know, when you do go on the ground in Cuba, you have, well, actually, up until now, up until the last 3 or 4 weeks, you know, you did have this sort of growing pessimism on the island. I'm not going to shy away from that. You know, when you did talk to people, it's grim, it's extremely difficult. And I was there at the end of 2024, so, you know, a bit over a year ago. And it was very difficult, but, you know, there was always that critical mass of people that understand that, you know, the true issue is not their system, in spite of the flaws it might have. It is that external pressure. And I think what we've seen, though, since the, not only since the new blockade or the oil blockade, but even over the deaths of those 32 Cubans in Venezuela, who killed during that US operation to kidnap Maduro, it has really, really solidified support for the government in Cuba.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, they've been facing this beast for many decades at this point. I was sort of wondering, how does this all fit into, like, I know it's a bit of a joke, but into, like, world, you know, international law? Like, where does that leave, like, our duty as a country on the world stage? Like, at some point, surely, at some point, we're meant to do something about this.
Yeah, look, according to every international law under the sun, according to national laws in every country, it is illegal to implement the type of blockade that the United States has implemented against Cuba for the past six plus decades. It is illegal to deny a country the right to normal commercial exchanges, particularly outside of wartime. Because as we know, Cuba and the United States officially are not at war. Even with the Bay of Pigs, they were not at war when that operation took place. So for this sort of economic coercion to be taking place is totally illegal. It's illegal according to UN law, all of the UN charters that deal with this type of issue. And as I mentioned, national laws in every country forbid this type of economic coercion against another country in these circumstances. And unfortunately, you know, as we know, there's very little that that most countries can do or are willing to do, unfortunately, because the US does still have quite a lot of oversight and power in the Americas and in the Caribbean particularly. Now, there are countries that do things. As I mentioned, you know, there are those large competitors of the United States, China, Russia, Iran, even Turkey, all trade with Cuba, and they send supplies to Cuba. But these are not, apart from China, these are not the major trading partners of the island. Most of those are still in Latin America, Venezuela, Mexico. And when you have this sort of blockade tightening around the island, you know, it makes, even for the Latin American countries, it makes these transactions very difficult, let alone countries that have to send, you know, their ships from thousands and thousands of kilometers away, crossing through multiple sea territories, having to get, you know, extra checks and extra insurance just to be able to send ships to Cuba. I mean, you know, it's often more hassle than it's worth for a lot of these companies. And, you know, if we're talking about Australia particularly, I mean, Australia does have a diplomatic relationship with Cuba. There's a Cuban embassy in Canberra, and Australia does deal with Cuban affairs through its embassy in Mexico. And we do have a limited amount of trade. It's very small, but there is trade there, and there are particularly sport and cultural exchanges that do take place between our two countries. And to Australia's credit, we have consistently voted against the US blockade at the UN since the vote began in the 90s, you know, which a lot of US allies have not done. There's many US allies that have voted against Cuba, particularly in the last round of elections when Trump really began to pressure some of these countries. But Australia did continue to vote against the blockade. But in terms of material support, you know, Australia, there's very little we can or we would consider doing for Cuba, because Cuba is still not a priority for us, you know.
Not as much as staying on the good graces of America.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Because, you know, I mean, we're already suffering from, I'm not sure what percentage anymore it is, but some degree of tariffs from the United States, which are impacting some of our industries. And, you know, we've seen that other countries that do get on the wrong side of the US, well, take Cuba, for example. I mean, it's not even just tariffs at that point. You're completely strangling the country. And of course, you know, there's no one in the Australian elite that would ever consider risking that sort of consequence for Cuba.
Yeah. What's something that people listening can do about this in their everyday life? Like, can we get, you know, involved in some stuff? Or, you know, you mentioned the Australia-Cuba Friendship Society. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's exactly right. The Australia-Cuba Friendship Society is the main group that organises events related to Cuba in Australia. It's got branches in all the major capital cities, so Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, and Canberra as well. And they're also the main organisation, in fact, the only organisation to my knowledge that actually sends money and supplies in any large quantity over to the islands, that, you know, has figured out ways to get them across. So, you know, recently we sent several thousand dollars across for an agricultural project in Cuba. And there is also the organising of the Southern Cross Brigade through that society, which is at the end slash start of every year, so end of December, start of January, people are able to go across to Cuba as a part of this brigade, and they're taken across the island for 3 weeks to visit different projects and different parts of the island and witness firsthand the reality that people in Cuba are facing. And there's a number of activities that they run here in all of the cities. For example, in Melbourne, there's a monthly meeting the first Monday of every month at the Melbourne Unitarian Church in East Melbourne. There's often commemoration events for important Cuban public holidays and public days, movie as well, the hosting of Cuban movies and Cuban food events as well. Lovely. So that's one of the main ways you can choose to get involved. But I'd also say even just, you know, if you do know something about Cuba and you know what the island is experiencing at the moment, just talking about it with other people and raising awareness about it is very, very important, because there's a lot of misconceptions. And I think now, just because of how blatant, you know, the US's actions are, it is a really good time and a good opportunity to actually draw attention to it, because I think now more than ever, it's very, very clear who is in the right and who is in the wrong. And of course, you know, it is the United States in the wrong and Cuba in the right, defending its right to be a sovereign country.
You just heard an interview between Alice and Spanish and Latin American Studies PhD researcher Sasha Galikas-Lukakis about the energy crisis facing Cuba due to the increased fuel blockade by the United States. Now, catch Sasha on 3CR's Latin American Update and Unitarian half-hour shows, and follow the work of the Australia-Cuba Friendship Society at melbourneacfs.org.
Amazing. And just a quick weather check. It is Thursday, the 5th of March, and the forecast for today is a maximum of 26 degrees. It's pretty muggy out there. I was already like sweating riding in. It's supposed to be feeling like 16.6 degrees outside, but I tell you what, if you're riding your bike around, wear a t-shirt. Don't wear long sleeves like I did. That was a mistake. You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:27 in the morning, and we are now going to a conversation that I had yesterday with Peter Cronow, award-winning investigative journalist, writer, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia. And we spoke about the Five Eyes intelligence agreement between Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States, and the role of Australia's Pine Gap's signal intelligence facility in light of the US-Israeli offensive on Iran. Now, remember, you can head to declassifiedaus.org. That's declassifiedaus.org for rigorous, in-depth coverage of Australia's role in the global military industrial complex. But for now, let's listen to this conversation with Peter. Look, Peter, thank you very much for making the time to speak with me. I just wanted to begin by asking you to remind us about Australia's involvement in the Five Eyes Agreement and, you know, the role and scope of signals intelligence coordination that Australia is involved in with countries including the United States.
Well, the Five Eyes Agreement itself has been around, you know, since the Cold War. And originally it was just called the UK-USA Agreement. But after the Cold War, it sort of moved into not trying to fight communism like supposedly it was doing back then, but to addressing strategic and even trade interests of member countries. So it's quite a different beast. Now, obviously, digital communications has been a revolution, and as a result, the ability to spy and intercept is just so much greater than ever possible. The Five Eyes Agreement is an interesting one at this stage to bring up, because there was a leak in the Washington Post not so long ago that showed a secret security partnership set up in the Middle East involving Israel and six other states of the Middle East has a partnership with the Five Eyes. And at least the Washington Post article quoted that the partnership involved distributing intelligence and operational material. Now, I've tried to find out more about it and reached some brick walls. But if that is an accurate report, then you've got a direct link between the Five Eyes intelligence group and the Israelis' own local intelligence group sharing intelligence. There's quite a link. It's not been published anywhere beyond in Australia, although it might be shortly published. So the Five Eyes Alliance is actually extending into policing and other security areas, into domestic surveillance. And there's even talk about expanding the Five Eyes, you know, outwards and including Japan and other countries. So it's the extraordinarily important grouping. It's Australia's most important intelligence sharing grouping.
As part of that, there is a very special role for the Joint Defence Facility at Pine Gap, and that Australian-United States coordination through that site of signals intelligence has been involved in, you know, surveilling and data gathering in the Middle East. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it's there is four Orion satellites that hover over from the Indian Ocean across to sort of North Africa, and they, where they look down, it covers large parts of the Middle East, you know, most of Europe and most of our Asia, Southeast Asia, the Pacific, but all four of them cover Iran. In doing that, it has the capability of being able to suck up any kind of information it may choose to look for. One of the key areas of SIGINT is military communications. So whether it be handheld radios, microwave communications, through to the communications used to remotely launch missiles. But it also includes handheld, you know, domestic phones and internet connections, and it can geolocate them down to, you know, within a meter or so, which is allowing targeting of individuals and individuals at meetings, for example. Beyond SIGINT, though, there's another thing that Pine Gap does. It's a relay ground station for overhead persistent infrared or space-based infrared system. And what that is highly sensitive infrared sensors picking up rocket launches, you know, even handheld rocket launches that may be occurring, but also missiles, ballistic missiles, ship-based missiles. It picks up at a very early stage the heat plume, the temperature plume that comes from a rocket, but it's able very quickly to identify the trajectory, the location it's been fired from, the likely targeting, the size of the rocket, its speed, quite a lot of information about it. So in this current war in Iran, started by the US and Israel, you know, missiles are playing an enormous part. There's no ground troops fighting each other. It's a missile, rocket and plane-based war. So therefore, it's highly important for that information for either side. And I don't think Iran's got many satellites, but certainly Israel has access to its own satellite. And it's also got access to intelligence gathered by the US through Pine Gap.
Yeah, I think it's really important that you've emphasized there the massive capabilities that are, you know, sort of housed in Pine Gap and via those satellite connections and relays, and how information sharing agreements between the United States and Israel also, you know, bring in an enormous amount of information that the United States is able to access through different partnerships. Now, Anthony Albanese made some pretty morally reprehensible statements in support of these strikes on Iran, and Foreign Minister Penny Wong has also been a bit ambiguous about the legality of the operations over the past few days and about Australia's involvement. I want to ask about your concerns about the potential for Australia to have either already been playing a role in this or to become involved as a direct party to this conflict.
It would be the most extraordinary circumstance that I couldn't imagine that Australia would not be performing that role right at this minute. That's precisely the reason for the construction of Pine Gap. It was built, finished in the 1970s, you know, initially used on the Vietnam War, just about every war since. It's been used to try to pick up intelligence to assist the US and its allies. There is absolutely no chance in the world that it's not being used. Now, I don't have somebody inside the base ringing me up and saying, hey, Peter, I just want to let you know, up on the big screen, we're seeing Iran at the moment. You know, that might be interesting to your readers. But in terms of capability, it is precisely for this reason that the base was built, to be able to inform particularly the United States, but also its allies, including Israel, of just the sort of intelligence that I was talking about, you know, missile launches and radio communications, geolocation information. So, you know, with an almost absolute degree of certainty, I can say that that sort of information is being passed on. The infrared information is automatically passed on as a relay, and some analysis happens in Australia, but the majority is just bounced across to the United States. The SIGINT material is largely processed in Australia. So Pine Gap's playing a role, and anyone who suggests it's not is really covering up the facts.
Yeah, I think this is a vital point when, you know, people make pretty standard assessments of whether or not a country is involved in a conflict. It's not just about boots on the ground or supply of weapons directly. This intelligence aspect is extremely important. So I appreciate you emphasizing that. Now, what will you be keeping an eye on when it comes to getting more of a sense of Australia's movements in relation to this latest phase of aggression by the United States and Israel?
Well, if I was living in Alice Springs, I'd be keeping an eye on the staff buses heading out to Pine Gap from the base, the location they've got in Alice Springs. Apparently, I've heard just yesterday that that no one's driving out to the base anymore; that all staff are going out in the bus with its darkened windows, you know, from inside a compound with, what is it, 3 meter high razor topped barbed wire. So obviously they're taking security pretty carefully. But what to take note of? Well, I think this is all hidden behind what's called, conveniently, national security. And for that reason, you will have seen that ministers flatly refused to discuss any aspect of the operation of Pine Gap or other facilities in Australia. And as a result, all you can really do is to follow the words that they say and follow the words that other people in the US particularly, who may be, you know, knowing about the sort of uses of the intelligence from Australia. Both Netanyahu and Trump have recently said some pretty worrying words about a much bigger hit on Iran to come. And given their capabilities, that's something to be feared. And one would hope that we could move to a ceasefire and negotiations. I mean, that's certainly what our government ought to be pushing as hard as it can. But it just seems too scared of the United States and too scared of offending them. And, you know, not without some basis, I've got to say. There is one other thing I should mention as well. We also operate a submarine communication base up on the Northwest Cape in Western Australia. And if there is going to be any nuclear launches from Israel's submarines, which they have five, I think, or from any of the US submarines, that signal and that communication will be transmitted through the base in Australia. There's no other way to communicate with those submarines. So, and there's other locations in Australia that are also contributing information for a potential seismic hit on Iran. You know, they've basically prepared targeting libraries so that by now they know the sorts of places that if Israel was going to use its nuclear weapons, or if the United States was going to use its nuclear weapons, it's already got the targets chosen. It doesn't need SIGINT from Pine Gap, but they've collected targeting libraries so that those libraries would have been put together with our help, with our ability to surveil those sorts of areas. So, you know, we're a part of an integrated system. It's not an easily visible system. Pine Gap's a long way away. And when we don't have marching bands waving off troops heading off at the airport, And when we don't have, you know, speeches being made about our contribution to the alliance, you can kind of get the impression that we're not really doing that much. But in my view, the base at Pine Gap and the other bases like Northwest Cape, Codgerina and a few others, they play a much bigger role than boots on the ground. What we could contribute would be quite small, a ship here, a couple of planes there, and soldiers. I mean, the bases are far, far more valuable to the United States and what it's doing in Iran.
Thank you for clarifying that. It is just terrifying to think about those directories, those libraries that have been created, and the amount of information that already exists to guide some pretty diabolical decision-making. Are there any other developing issues that our listeners should be aware of or keeping an eye on in relation to Australia's relationship to this conflict, but also just more broadly in terms of what the US and Israel are, you know, doing at the moment?
Look, I think Israel is being an extraordinarily powerful vassal state to the United States. I think the United States has a much bigger agenda, and for the Middle East, Israel plays a part. You know, for Europe, Ukraine plays the part to confront Russia. And, you know, living in the Pacific, I'm a little bit more leery about the idea of this pivot back to Asia. I think that the goal of the US is domination. And within that domination, if you're on the right side, then you just think you've got a peaceful world and everything's running fine. But basically, it's domination of and subjugation, you know, subjugation of countries. So they do as you want. Australia is subjugated. We do as they want. And China doesn't. And to me, that's the biggest fear, that the United States build-up in Australia is part of a huge build-up right throughout Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific, with the aim being eventually to confront China. And the thing to watch out for listeners to keep an ear open for is blockades, shipping blockades of China. That's how, in my view, and other analysts, that's how it's going to start. Panama, Greenland, the Sunda Strait in Indonesia. These locations can easily be blockaded, which would lead to, you know, the strangulation of China's economy. They're not called choke points for no good reason. So I think it's definitely worthwhile keeping an eye on those sorts of things if you follow these issues. And I think, you know, not to be blinded by the clown performance of somebody like Trump, but to look behind it and look at the overall continuing trends. And the continuing trend is domination.
That was a fantastic conversation, super informative. And if you want to go back and listen to any of that, remember, you can always listen back to our previous episodes of Thursday Breakfast by heading to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. We podcast all of our programs. That was Peter Cronow, who is an award-winning investigative journalist, writer, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia. And he was speaking about the Five Eyes intelligence agreement between Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States, and the role of Australia's Pine Gap Signals Intelligence Facility in light of the US-Israeli war on Iran. Just some really important information in there as well about the role of other bases around Australia for relaying information. And I think something that really struck me was the Northern Western Australia nuclear submarine base, and the fact that information would need to be relayed through there were the United States or Israel to organize a strike on Iran via their own nuclear submarines. And I think that final point that Peter made about the trend being domination is so important, just to zoom out and think about how this fits into broader imperial geostrategic maneuvers. So definitely head to Declassified Oz, that's declassifiedaus.org, for more rigorous in-depth coverage of Australia's role in the global military industrial complex. And thank you so much again to Peter for joining us.
Yeah, an amazing interview, Priya. And now I am joined by Io Diaz from the Centre Against Racial Profiling, joining me to discuss the safety and accountability concerns with the extension of Operation Pulse until the end of this year, which is continuing targeted Victoria Police patrols and protective service officers at shopping centres, particularly in racially discriminated against areas. Thanks so much for joining us here today. How are you?
Yes, I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. I wanted to talk to you about the Operation Pulse, which is an extension of, you know, Victoria Police patrols and PSOs that have been put in shopping centres, probably from the, you know, Christmas, Boxing Day. And now it has been extended with $6.5 million and extended to the end of the year. But I wanted to ask about, you know, with your work in community legal work and against racial profiling, when it comes to the kind of patrols that they're doing in shopping areas, why do you think that these shopping centres were chosen, and what does, I guess, how does decisions like that even get made?
Good question. I think what we see in these patterns of policing public spaces is that police have a very targeted focus on certain communities. If you look at the designated areas, for example, you know, they're very targeted as to who gets those powers get applied to. It's often racialized communities. It's often protests, and it's often young spaces where young people hang around. So in this particular case, Operation Pulse in the shopping centres, I mean, I think it was very obvious that the government was responding to a so-called crime crisis around youth crime. I mean, quotation marks for all that.
Yeah.
And I think the government saw itself and thus police needing to be seen as responding to that, and so put in these extra measures of moving PSOs from train stations to the shopping centres. Now, there's only certain shopping centres, but these are the ones where the most racialised communities are. So the ones out east, the one out west, the one in the north. Right, these are the places where it's seen as government needing to respond. So it's actually. A lot of it's politics, I would say.
Yes, definitely.
And a lot of it, and at the end of it, the communities that get played around by these policies are always the same. It's migrant, racialized, and mostly young people.
Yeah,
bearing the brunt of it.
Yeah, I really want to draw to that. I mean, even recently there was the Ramadan market that was announced as a designated area, which is pretty clear, in its discrimination. And yeah, particularly one that it's an election year and that are also trying to make sure that the election year is, you know, seen, you know, Sister Alice is seen as fighting crime as opposed to, like, actually there's a cost of living crisis right now. There are other factors that are probably contributing to, you know, sort of shoplifting, but putting $6.5 million into, you know, searching shoppers without warrants. How is that detrimental to the, I guess, the image of, you know, so-called stopping crime? Because, yeah, there's a lot of propaganda happening here.
Yeah, there's a lot of propaganda happening. And I think, you know, that amount of money, that amount of money, if you could imagine it being used in any other sort of place, in any other sort of spaces, in terms of, you know, if safety is actually the concern for these piece of work, then you could put that money into so many different services and so many different community groups to make sure that we are addressing safety in a different way other than policing, right? And so you can see where the priorities are. This is also a government that keeps saying that they're broke, that they have no money, that they can't spend money on Vic Health, on CoHealth, on any of these other things, but they have this amount of money to spend on policing young people. Right? That tells you something as to where the priorities are. And of course, you know, this is an orchestrated piece of work, not necessarily by the state government. It's very interesting if you read the reports and online and in the ABC and in other media reports. There's always a retail association behind the numbers, behind
yes.
that they're the ones that are pushing these theft crimes, they're the ones pushing the satisfaction of the police being in there, they're the ones pushing these surveys out. So you can see from the very beginning, from the moment that they were calling for more PSOs in shopping centres, you could see the fingerprints of this retail association behind it. And so that's the government responding to a very big and powerful player in the space.
Yeah.
And it shows that when our community are pushing for the same for different types of reforms or money into our services, we don't get any response. So they obviously don't see us as a big, mean and important player.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because I was going to speak about how, one, the crime statistics are so important for leveraging, propaganda, but also, putting it in the report, and then how these statistics get made. Like, these are not fully neutral numbers. And I was going to ask, how it says in the report that was released on Sunday, new data shows 84% of customers at Victorian shopping centres felt safer. Like, who would put that forward? I think asking those kind of critical questions is really vital. And as you mentioned, with the retailers and traders, have stopped the second supervised injecting room with increased community policing in Footscray and in the Melbourne city. As you said, retails are such a big player. How do you think retail traders are contributing to how these survey results are perpetuated?
Yeah, look, I think they are definitely a big player, and they're an important player for any municipality, any council, any state government, because the government and of the day wants to be seen as fostering economic growth, for whatever that means. And so they're obviously in the pocket there, and the traders trying to get what they want. And so I think the issue is that. I think the issue is that there's, especially the bigger retail and traders associations, or the big ones, they're the ones with the direct line into lobbying, and the money to be able to do this, right? The smaller ones are the ones that are not able to do this and bear the brunt. And so, bear the brunt of the bigger decisions. And so I don't want to lump them all into one category, but it's obviously the ones that get shoplifted. So if you're looking at Coles, at Bunnings, at Woolies, Kmart, right? These are big, massive players that have millions of dollars of profit every year. Shoplifting in their shops, for as much as they want to say it's a crime, we're in the cost of living crisis, it's a non-violent crime, right? And so the push to be able to ask for more policing, which in turn might actually increase violent crime towards young people, is disproportionate. Like, what's the point of that, right? And so I think, these big organisations or big retail associations, they have the money to push forward surveys. They have the money to be able to kind of look at the data and analyse it in a way that they want. And so it means that they own the narrative. And that's the biggest part, is that they own the narrative right now, and the narrative is not owned by us, but the community.
Yeah, I think owning the narrative is so important. I mean, even if you look at the data, it's from the Shopping Centre Council of Australia. And as you said, not lumping it all together, but that in combination with what you've just spoken about is important. One, they also have loss prevention, and we know that, it's a cost of living crisis. I don't think the solution is, having really scary patrols where you can be searched without a warrant, and then having planted Israeli tech to surveil people. I mean, when it comes to, yeah, like what actually supports crimes of poverty a lot of the time, or places where young people gather is shopping centres. What do you think, yeah, supports the reduction in crime? Like, you know, as you said, they said you're not able to put in money into the increase of Centrelink, but you can for, you know, this program.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, what is crime, right? Crime is a social construct. Crime is the fact that, you know, police can go around and hurt you, bash you, arrest you, deprive you of your freedom of movement and political expression. But if I do that, that's a crime.
Yep, absolutely.
Right? So obviously, you know, it's about defining the terms. And so when we're saying stop crime or lower crime rates, like, what is it that we're actually saying? And I think because we're not talking about, yeah, we're not talking about police doing that. We're talking about, and we're also not talking about, you know, white collar crime, like bankers defrauding millions of dollars of people. Right? We're not talking about that. Well, what we talk about when we often say crime, we're talking about the people that we don't like, the people that society doesn't want to have to deal with and doesn't like and see. The crime, as a word, is defined to the people who they can scapegoat and use as political fodder. And so there's this whole idea of, like, we need to stop the crime rates, a lower crime rates. Like, yes, there are moments in which society is not safe, or, you know, there's risk factors in everything that people do. But it's about our appetite and our society, about how we deal with risk, right? And I think that's what the conversation needs to be. It needs to be about what can we deal with in terms of risky behavior, and what can't we, and not about punishing and using the word crime to actually mean racism, biases, and to mean actually we can do whatever we want with this particular cohort of people.
Yeah, thank you so much, Iyo. It's so important to talk about. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us here today to talk about Operation Pulse. It's so important, and yeah, particularly in an election year, but you know that this doesn't actually support the people that it claims that it does.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And that was Ilio Diaz from the Centre Against Racial Profiling, who joined me to discuss the safety and accountability concerns with the extension of Operation Pulse until the end of this year.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR Digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8 o'clock in the morning, and we are about to go to our next segment for the day. Now, just a content note, this interview does include some distressing themes, including a discussion of state-sanctioned sexual violence. So if you need to talk to someone after listening, you can always ring Lifeline on 131114 or the Suicide Callback Service on 1-300-659-467. Alternatively, you can rejoin us from 8:15 a.m. for our final interview of the show. Georgia Shields and Nina Story from the Formerly Incarcerated Girls Justice Advocates Melbourne Collective, or FIGJAM, spoke with me recently about the dehumanising practice of strip searching in the Australian correction system and why this practice needs to end. FIGJAM, Flat Out and Human Rights Law Centre have just launched a co-authored report titled Ending Strip Searches in Australian Prisons, which details the harm, prevalence and ineffectiveness of strip searching, drawing on a combination of information obtained by Freedom of Information requests and the testimony of formerly incarcerated people, including members of FIGJAM Collective. The report, published at endstripsearching.com, is accompanied by a petition calling on the federal government to ban strip searches across all Australian prisons. And endstripsearching.com also has a link to donate to support Fig Jam Collective's work. Georgia and Nina, thanks so much for making time to speak with me.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Priya. Really good to be on the show again.
Yes, it's always a pleasure, even though it's going to be a pretty tough conversation, tough topic today. Before we get into it, do either of you want to talk about how to sort of best prepare yourself to hear what we're going to talk about, you know, about strip searches, about these really harmful themes of state-sanctioned sexual violence? Do you have any advice for listeners?
Yeah, I guess I just want folks to be mindful that we are going to be talking about sexual assault, especially in relation to it being authorised and perpetrated by the state. And if this is triggering for you or if it brings something up for you, please reach out to your family and your friends and get the love and support that you need. You don't need to do this alone. I know it can be really daunting to ask for support, but I know from my experiences that when I do speak up, the people that love and care for me are there for me. So just encourage folks to do that.
Thanks, Nina. Now, to begin with, can you talk about what strip searches are and how they work?
Strip searches, they're done by people in positions of power. You're ordered to take off all your clothes in front of them. Sometimes you have to do things like lift your breasts and, you know, open your mouth, show behind your ears, and then even like squat and cough, show between your bum cheeks. You have to like remove your tampons and your pads, and they will inspect those too and things like that. It's pretty traumatizing, especially if you've been through sexual violence, which a lot of women have, most women have. But I also wrote a letter to my friends and family after I'd been incarcerated. This is about 2 weeks after. And this was my experience of my first and luckily my only strip search while I was incarcerated. So I'll read that out for you. After leaving with the correctional officer at the back of the courtroom, I was taken to the holding cells underneath the county court. I was immediately taken into a horrible grey room with cold white lighting by two female officers and ordered to take my clothes off one by one, shake each item and hand them to be inspected. I was standing there completely naked with no comfort being offered by these officers, as I am now officially convicted scum of society. As most, if not all of you know, nudity is not something that scares nor intimidates me. But this was truly horrible. I was no longer empowered in my body in these moments, but made to stand naked with an overwhelming sense of shame, guilt, and humiliation, something I've never felt while being naked before, not in this way at least. Ironically, they then left the room to give me privacy to redress myself, but they took part of my dignity with them and have been trying to take back the pieces ever since. So yeah, that's how it felt.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And thank you for sharing that, because I can imagine that, you know, talking about it also brings back those memories. So it's not easy. We'll move into the question of what strip searches are actually intended to achieve. Where are they used and do they actually work?
I think that on paper, they're intended to find contraband. And I think that we're led to believe this means like weapons and like drugs and things like that. Realistically, they don't find much. They find like less than 1% of the time they actually find anything at all. And when they do find something, it's like gum and like paper clips. And it's very rarely anything that's dangerous at all. So I don't really know what they're for, apart from punishment, it seems like, to us, as a way to control us and exert power over us.
Nina, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, just that I think that we are society and community are fed a lie and so many lies when it comes to the prison system, especially around safety and sort of what prison entails. And strip searching is one of those practices that we're led to believe creates safety. But like Jo's already said, that it doesn't create any worse or better environments, that it is purely used as a weapon of coercion and power and control. And in the prison system, we just have to be really mindful of some of the language that they use too. Like, you know, they have a therapeutic unit and the post-separation practice program, which is isolation. And, you know, and there's no healing and recovery within prisons. And so I think it's really important to let the listeners know that, it doesn't provide safety. It is, and I'll use the language of the prison. They say it's to maintain good order, which, like, in itself does showcase that it's used as a method of power and control. And we do have alternatives to prevent contraband from coming into the prison, like x-ray machines and wands, which are a lot more effective. And I also want the listeners to know that the word contraband can mean a number of different items. Like, it's framed in our minds as weapons and things that possibly could cause somebody else harm. But from the report, if folks want to read it, it's entails that the contraband is actually more things like medication, chewing gum, tobacco, SIM cards, which really speaks to the inability for people while they're incarcerated to get their needs met. They don't have access to medication and things like that, and that's why they resort to trying to get medication in for themselves.
Nina, I wanted to go back to you to ask about how strip searches fit into this broader system of dehumanization of people who are incarcerated, and how do they impact upon women and gender diverse people, and also children in particular?
Yeah, I mean, like, right now, right across prisons in so-called Australia, including children as young as 12 years old, are being forced to expose and contort their bodies for inspection under the guise of security. And, you know, and this is obviously a really stark power dynamic, but children are undergoing these strip searches by adults. And so where is the protection for these young people? Strip searches are deeply traumatic and are experiences and acts of sexual assault and coercive control. And victim survivors and family violence survivors and child abuse survivors are being re-traumatized by these harmful practices that achieve absolutely nothing. Hundreds of strip searches have found no contraband at all. And, you know, being in what we think is a progressive country with a government that promises to eradicate violence in one generation, I have absolutely no understanding how we can authorize state-sanctioned sexual assault.
Yeah, I found that my experience when I was in there was that so many of the officers were seemingly in this job in order to have a place to freely abuse people without any repercussion. There's no rules in there for them. They can do what they want. They don't have to really, you know, report any of the stuff that they're doing. So when you think about people that are going in there to just, like, generally abuse people, you have to think about, like, are there people that are getting this job so that they can go into the youth system and sexually abuse children as well by strip searching them, because strip searching is sexual assault. So you just have to really think about how many predators are getting jobs in places like that as well. It's pretty frightening.
Yeah, and I think something that the report draws attention to and really makes, you know, non-negotiable is the fact that this is not a practice that would be accepted in any other part of society, and yet it is accepted as part of the way that the correction system operates, as a normal part of the way the correction system operates. When it comes to actually getting a sense of how often this happens, what are some of the issues that you've seen in terms of, you know, corrections officers actually reporting how they've conducted these searches, when they've conducted these searches, and the difference in the kinds of reporting that, you know, Georgia, you've done in your letter to your family and friends versus how this stuff's recorded?
Yeah, I think given that we've got a number of different prisons across Australia, some are maximum security, some are low security, some are private, some are, you know, in different states and territories, we've got different legislation, different rules, different procedures of how we collect data. And even the FOI process that the Human Rights Law Centre went through, it was a years of a fight to be able to get that. And you can tell from the data that what we received was vastly different from different states. So it's very clear that there's no real clear legislation or policy around how data is collected and what sort of information is collected. But from what we did get, it vastly proves that they are completely ineffective and unnecessary.
Now, I wanted to ask about the use of less invasive alternatives to strip searches. In the report, you talk about how this can be a step in the right direction, but that we should also be cautious still about how these alternatives are used. Nina, could you speak to what some of those alternatives are? I know you touched on a few at the start.
Yeah, like, you know, we've got x-ray machines within some of the prisons that don't get used as often as they could. And also it's the same x-ray machines that you would find at an airport. So folks would be familiar with that, and they have a very clear understanding that walking through that does not cause any sort of harm. And also that there are wands that can be brushed over your clothing that can also detect drugs or, you know, other substances. So there's definitely things that are more effective. And I mean, you know, these routine sort of inspections before and after every time that you leave the prison or enter a prison or move prisons, I think too that the prison needs to take some accountability as well, that we have been in their care. So why do we need an under complete scrutiny and surveillance from the point where we might be going out for a medical treatment? This is including when women are giving birth, that when we come back from giving birth, we do not need to be strip searched. You know, we've given birth under the surveillance of the department. So it's absolutely unnecessary.
I just wanted to say, when I after I was strip searched at the court, I was put into a cell, and then I was taken from the cell to a truck, from the truck to the prison. I was never like out of the sights of any of these officers, and they've strip searched me already. And then when I get to the prison, I'm put into this x-ray machine, and it's not even, it's like, I think some airports have them, but it's like those extra detailed ones. Like, they made a comment that I was wearing a bikini top as a bra. They were like, oh, are you wearing a bikini top as a bra? I was fully clothed. So it's like, why did they feel the need to strip search me when they've got this like higher technology there that is much more useful for everyone involved, much less invasive for me? I don't understand what the need for the strip search was at the very beginning. It just seemed like a way to dominate and show their power. So I think it's completely unnecessary to do the strip search in the first place.
It does show how violent that power dynamic is. I understand that alongside the launch of the Ending Strip Searching in Australian Prisons report, you're also starting a petition. What are you demanding, and how can listeners sign?
Yeah, we're demanding that strip searches are banned in all prisons in Australia by law. And we've got a petition on change.org. The petition is called Petition to Australian Governments, Ban Strip Searches in Australian Prisons. So if you could go ahead and sign that, we hope to make some positive change.
Awesome. We will include a link to that in our show notes. And is there anything else that you both wanted to mention before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would just like to thank all of the formerly incarcerated folks, all of the allies, all of the people that have been putting up the fight to end strip searching. Flat Out has been instrumental in this. They've been doing the work for about 35 years, and I'm so grateful for that. It makes the work feel lighter. I do want to give a very, very special shout out to Aunt Vicky Roach, who is so incredibly dear to me and was the first formerly incarcerated advocate that I'd ever met and gave me so much hope in the space. She's also written the foreword for the report. So, yeah, massive shout out to you, Auntie.
Amazing. And there's a beautiful picture of her in there as well. All right. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Priya.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that was Georgia Shields and Nina Story from Fig Jam Collective speaking about the dehumanizing practice of strip searching in the Australian correction system and why this practice needs to end. Head to endstripsearching.com to find out more about today's report and to donate to Fig Jam's work, as well as sign a petition calling on the federal government to ban strip searches across Australian prisons.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In NAM, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection.
You're listening to Community Radio.
3CR.
855 AM.
For native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
And now, Sarah Blumfeld will be joining us to share more about Don't Fly Thai, a campaign rejecting the transport of F-35 fighter jet parts from so-called Australia to the illegal state of Israel on commercial passenger planes. Next, Sarah will give us the latest on the campaign actions, including protests at Melbourne and Sydney international airports on the 25th of February, which prompted a global response via their social media coverage. Good morning, Sarah, and welcome to Thursday Breakfast.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, I thought we could start with some basics about the campaign. Can you tell us what is Don't Fly Thai, and when and how did you yourself and organisers become aware of the transport of F-35 parts on commercial passenger flights?
Yes. So Don't Fly Thai is a relatively, like, a very new campaign, although it is part of a wider push of campaigns that we have had, that we have been organising over the past year or more.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Fly Thai is specifically targeting the transfer of F-35 parts on by Thai Airways from Sydney to Tel Aviv via Bangkok. We became aware of this through articles published by Declassified Australia, who have done wonderful work and research in this area. They published a series of articles in the last quarter last year. And we were aware of it through their work. We then began to look at our campaign early this year, targeting Australia's F-35 supply for Israel's genocide jet. And we were looking at how to approach it. And we knew that Thai Air was flying the parts, but it probably wasn't until one of our social media artist was putting together a reel that included all of the different logos from different companies that are involved in the whole process.
Mm.
So that Lockheed Martin and Thai Air, and Thai Air was right there. And then within days, we had a letter campaign targeting Thai Air, boycott Thai Air. They are flying parts for genocide from Australia to Israel.
Yeah, thank you for that background, Sarah. Now, the campaign recently, in the last week or 2 weeks, has had a really important impact and a significant impact in that it's actually brought awareness, a global awareness to this issue via its social media coverage. Can you tell me a bit more about your most recent actions and the future goals for the campaign?
So last week we had 7 actions take place across 3 different states, particularly in New South Wales, in Sydney, on Gadigal country, and in Melbourne at NAM. So those actions targeted the international airports, and groups of activists attended each of their airports several times with signage, with flyers, with letters, just quietly attending the international airports, making the passengers aware that they would be flying on a flight that includes the parts for genocide, and also handing the personnel who work for Thai Airways copies of the letters to provide to their management as well.
Yeah. Now, there was, as I mentioned, a significant response to this. The Thai Airways CEO, Chai Imsiri, actually responded to the social media coverage of these actions. And on the 26th of February, Nation Thailand actually reported that the CEO of Thai Airways said, "People who understand," this isn't a quote, this is paraphrasing, but basically, "people who understand standard aviation procedure do not support the boycott," which is kind of speaks to this normalization of these practices, you know, implying that it's normal to carry weapons parts on commercial passenger flights and that they are the same as any other kind of car parts or anything else that a passenger plane would carry. And this speaks to a quote from you also, which I really found interesting. You said, you described this normalization as the creep of militarization into civilian infrastructures. Can you expand on what that means?
Yes, I can. So it really is a form of stealthing, I consider it. We have all of these various companies, which are probably not commonly known yet, but they will become more so as time goes on. So there's Raytheon, Sarah, Rosebank, Marand, Heat Treatment Australia, to name a few. These companies are all some of the more than 100 Australian companies who have contracts to supply F-35 parts and components. So we have become very embedded in the F-35 genocide economy. And these companies, they're not always in industrial areas out of sight, though sometimes they are, and sometimes they'll deliberately not have branding so that they're not known about. But they're also, over the past at least few decades, they have a modus operandi of starting to hide in plain sight. So they are within our communities, they're in our suburbs, they're in our neighbourhoods. They're these little companies, these little factories that are popping up. You know, no one's quite sure what they're doing there, but, you know, people would be surprised if they did manage to pop their head in and see, which some of some actionists that I know have had the opportunity to do that on occasion and are really taken aback to be confronted with huge missiles sitting in those, you know, in those little buildings or bomb adapters so that F-35s can drop a whole different range of bombs because there aren't enough of the standard size bomb available. You know, that particular factory is in a really nice leafy suburb in Brisbane, in Tingalpa. These companies, they're also next to schools, they're investing in schools, they're investing in communities, they're, you know, they're presenting themselves as normal and no questions have been raised yet. The people of Australia have not been given the opportunity to consent to having these in our midst because the question has not yet been asked.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really important part of all this, is that the lack of transparency really takes away our right to consent to supporting these companies and businesses. Could you, to wrap up today, could you tell me if there's somewhere that listeners can actually access a list of these businesses so that we know who to boycott? And how can we continue to support the Don't Fly Thai campaign?
Yes. So you can't really boycott the actual companies because, we're not buying missiles, but we certainly can make it known. A lot of those companies are making other goods as well. So, yes, we can boycott those goods. WagePeace's website has good information. WagePeace and Disruptors have good information on their Instagram site as well. There's also a weapons map available via the WagePeace website that listeners can go to and click on there, and it actually sort of, it drills down and shows alarmingly all of the different weapons companies and factories embedded in our community. So I apologise. I think this is a two-part question. Would you mind repeating the second part?
Oh, yeah. The second part, thanks for that information. We will include it on our podcast notes.
Great.
Then just to wrap up, how can people support the Don't Fly Thai campaign, and where can they do that?
Yeah, so to begin with, I'd like to say that I think that people want to be able to do something. The response to the Don't Fly Thai air campaign, has been phenomenal. There's been more than 3,000 letters sent already. So there
Amazing.
Is a, we have a letter campaign, and people can go to the letter campaign and send letters to let Thai Airways know that they aren't happy.
Yep.
They can. We also will be beginning a phone Thai Airway campaign as well, so people will be able to phone Thai Airways and let them know how unhappy they are. Of course, people can speak with their feet and don't fly Thai. For those who don't know, one of the reasons that Thai Airways is the carrier of the weapons and the parts and components for the F-35 planes in Israel is because they code share with El Al, Israel Air.
Right.
So it means that the plane continues on from Bangkok to Tel Aviv and doesn't have to have the cargo removed
Yes.
and put on another flight. So, if people aren't already boycotting El Al as well, then, that's something else to consider.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
You're welcome.
We have to wrap up for today, but you've left us with some really important information, and thank you so much for sharing your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You just heard Sarah Blumfield, who joined us to share more about the Don't Fly Thai campaign, which rejects the transport of F-35 fighter jet parts from so-called Australia to Israel via commercial passenger planes on Thai Airways.
Yes, and we are coming up to the end of our show today. So if you want to listen back, remember you can head to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. In our show today, we had Sasha Gillies-Lukakis on to talk about the fuel blockade by the United States on Cuba. We also heard from Peter Cronow about Australia's involvement in the Five Eyes partnership and the Pine Gap facility. Ilo Diaz from the Center Against Racial Profiling spoke with us about Operation Pulse in Victoria. And members of Fig Jam Collective spoke with us about ending strip searches in Australian prisons. And finally, as you just heard, we were joined by Sarah Blumfield to talk about Don't Fly Thai. We'll catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.